COP26.
UN Climate Conference. COP26.
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 It's the 26th conference of parties.
COP26.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said he might not attend the UN Climate Conference in Scotland in November.
We've seen a huge lack of leadership engagement.
It's very exciting for the eyes of the world to be on our home city.
In November 2021, the world comes to Glasgow, our home city, as it hosts COP27.
I hope everybody can come with us.
And welcome to the Path to COP podcast, a podcast dedicated to environmental, social governance, and all issues relating to sustainability, asset management, and finance. In this special series of three episodes, sponsored by Nordea Asset Management, this podcast is brought to you in association with the Global Ethical Finance Initiative and its Path to COP26.com campaign. My name is JB Beckett, and I will be your host on this podcast.
Dear Sarah and Michaela, welcome to the Path to COP podcast. And of course we have Sarah, CEO of Minerva, and Michaela from Nordea. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Same here.
And of course I'll drop your bios into the episode link. So why are we speaking today? Well, funnily enough, we've had this little event in Glasgow that you may be aware of. And, you know, with COP26 recently ending, we have, I guess, this opportunity to review what has been achieved or perhaps what remains to be done as investors. Glasgow then seemed a necessary moment, I guess, to convert the hope of Paris into hope progress. For me, for the first time, it actually felt like finance actually turned up and they appeared fully present and ready and willing to step up at COP, or at least certainly that was the impression given. And certainly governments conceded they needed private finance to meet the cost of transition. So with that in mind, can I start by asking you both, and I'm going to pick on you first, Sarah, if you don't mind. What COP outcome impressed you the most? And I guess conversely, therefore, which disappointed you as well?
Well, I think you've already touched on it, JB, which is that finance was there. You know, we actually had a finance day. And I think for a very long time, there has been this disconnect between the sort of the international political order and how that filters down through the system to the investment community. And for all the criticism of GFANs, the fact that we've actually got senior financial leaders at the table talking about what they're going to be doing to help achieve these objectives, I think is just pretty amazing, because I think for so long, climate change has been seen as a fringe NGO, green, you know, bunny-hugging activity, rather than the business of serious risk management. And I've been reading a lot in the papers recently, oh, woe is me, wasn't COP a catastrophe, we haven't achieved anything. And you just have to turn around to them and say, you know, governments are enablers, but at the end of the day, it's civil society and finance, which is actually going to deliver these promises. Mm. You cannot sort of on the one hand say that business needs to thrive in a free enterprise system with no government interference, and then bemoan the lack of government interference. You know, that's sort of trying to have your cake and eat it.
Right.
For me, I think that is a big, you know, that China, you know, hasn't necessarily apparently done all the things that everybody wanted. The ratchet, that mechanism is just going to get harder and harder and harder. That there will be increasingly fewer places to hide. And I think the finance community has actually shown, particularly ESG and stewardship teams have shown, is a very strong willingness to actually stand up to companies, engage with companies. It doesn't matter where they're located, to actually say why this matters to them. So, yeah, the days of sort of sovereign states and governments being the exclusive forum for change, they're long gone.
And Michaela, I guess same question to you. What, I guess, impressed you most from COP and what perhaps left you a little disappointed?
Very interesting question. And also building on what Sarah said, I've observed the same development. And to be very fair, I'm not sure how I feel about it. To a certain extent, it means that we in finance need to develop tools to address this sort of systemic issue. And when it comes to having the right toolbox, normally states and governments are better placed simply because of the kind of entity that they are. So what the difficulty is going to be if the financial community is carrying a lot of the responsibility for delivering these outcomes is what do we have in order to ensure that they also happen? I guess for me, the biggest disappointment was the lack of a sufficient binding element in many of the pledges. And that includes basically what the financial sector has taken upon themselves. So as a representative of a financial institution, I'm partly happy, or for a lack of a better word, satisfied that my sector seems to be stepping up to the responsibility. But we also need to be very careful to hold ourselves accountable, because we are in a very different position when it comes to accountability than a government. And outside of the tool of reputational risk, in the absence of regulation, there is not much that can be done to hold us to a word, if you like. And that's a risk, and also a huge, huge, huge responsibility. So that is one aspect of it. So, to build on the point of not enough binding elements, that is one disappointing aspect. The other is obviously the weakening of wording on coal. We can, as financial institutions, as investors, phase out renewable fossil fuel financing as much as we like, but if states step up to provide it, then the effect of that sadly will be limited. And if you look at the biggest emitters of fossils in the world right now, and the ones that have the most to gain in terms of best practices, and the ones that have the farthest to go, it will all be, in many, many cases, state-owned entities, not the ones that are listed, not the ones that are targets of shareholder campaigns. So I do have a very great worry that the lack of binding instruments and the softening of the language on coal will basically put a lot of emissions out of the reach of investor engagement and out of the reach of shareholder activism, because they will end up with state-owned entities. And that's a huge, huge worry for me. And the last disappointing element of the COP is, I suppose, that the people that stand to have the most to lose from the outcomes, and the ones that are most vulnerable, did not necessarily get a chance to speak their minds and to raise their concerns sufficiently. And with that, I mean largely indigenous representatives, because any new exploration, sadly, will happen in their territories, and also a lot of the effects of climate change will play out on these poorest and most vulnerable members of global society. And I think they definitely should have gotten more of a hearing. Why am I nonetheless cautiously optimistic? If you sum up all the net zero goals and all of the pledges, you do come out at something below 2 degrees. You do come out at 1.8 or so degrees. There is the huge risk of not having sufficient enforcement elements, and that's not a trifling thing. But it is, and that we have to acknowledge, the first time that we've managed to push the total of commitments under a two degrees of warming scenario. And that is something to be positive about.
Yeah, thanks, Michaela. I could hear you busily scribbling in your notes in the background, Sarah.
Sadly, I've reached an age, if I don't write things down, then it's a case of the last thing in. Then something else has to fall out the other side.
It was great. So, it sounded like someone is still using a pencil and a rubber and a razor. Were you still using a razor?
I have a very, very trusty Faber-Castell Grip Plus 0.7, which... which is brilliant. So I'd like to return to a couple of the points that Michaela made.
Please do.
Thinking about pension schemes who we look after, it seems that I think not everybody has fully recognised the immense power and leverage that asset owners now have. I'm thinking here particularly of UK asset owners, which have baked into their job description to be enforcers throughout the system. They are the beginning of that sort of supply demand engine. And the fact that increasingly, you know, scope three needs to be included in their considerations has a cascade effect throughout the system. Now, the speed of which that cascade will happen is definitely something to be anxious about. But I'm very conscious of the fact that actually shareholders have many, many more powers than often governments do to actually force through changes. And that's often not discussed widely enough in the financial sector. So we're working with a number of pension schemes at the moment who are thinking very seriously about changing their benchmarks, changing their managers, if those managers cannot deliver on promises which will help those pension schemes achieve a net zero. I mean, the biggest challenge for them is trying to decide, you know, is it going to be 2030, 2050, you know, what can they do? But they have this legal obligation. In fact, I heard somebody say the other day that they felt that asset owners had been weaponized in the fight against climate change, which I thought was possibly a bit of an exaggeration. But I could see where they're coming from is, you know, they are starting to be demanding because, you know, they've got very long time horizons. They're looking at sort of 30, 40 years out. And if you look at sort of schemes like Nest, for example, they've made climate change a central plank of all of their investing, to the point, I think, where very soon we'll see people not talking about ESG investing or climate change investing. They'll just talk about investing because they will just bake ESG and particularly climate change risks into their normal risk schedule. And I think that's it doesn't seem very much to say, oh, well, yeah, there was a finance day. But it is massive and it is pivotal. And I think the work of TCFD in getting global financial regulators to start to coalesce, to get IOSCO in on this, these are massive changes that, you know, okay, it's taken 5 years, but thank goodness Mark Carney's team have got sort of plenty of energy to do this. But the enforcement is a fair point, but I'm certainly seeing asset owners now starting to sharpen their pencils when they're running the rule over what asset managers are doing, or in some cases, just not doing.
Sorry for jumping in there.
No, please do, please do, please do.
Because I do feel very strongly that good owners are, and I've experienced this many times as somebody working on the asset manager side, good owners, the sort of client that will actually make demands on our financial product, are a huge, huge power for change. And this is exactly the client that we want to serve, and that's exactly the client that we want to make suitable products for, because in the end, there is, in the hands of asset owners, the huge power of capital allocation, and that is indeed a tremendous thing. Two more points to make there, I suppose. One issue that we, and I very much say we, because I do think that asset managers and asset owners need to work together on that one. How do we make sure that the fact that we don't invest in high emitters actually makes the emissions go away? And that is a very big challenge, because the there are many ways to build a low-carbon product. One is by buying low-carbon businesses, which has its own risk, because the safest way to build a low-carbon portfolio, I return to this example over and over, is to only buy software companies that only make emojis, you know. So that's clearly a tool with a lot of limitations. You have to be very careful as a capital allocator where in the value chain do you invest? If the product or service has a cost in carbon, what do you get for that? And you have to get a much more granular picture of the impacts of business models if you do take on that task on yourself as a capital allocator. Otherwise, you face the situation that just the fact that you don't invest, say, in companies like Petrobras, or you don't invest in Exxon, it doesn't mean that Petrobras or Exxon emit even 1 kilo of CO2 less because of that. So you have to really be very mindful of the impacts of your portfolio. And that leads me to my second point. You can't be mindful of these impacts without good universal reporting standards. Nordea, we have been a very early supporter of TCFD. We are one of the pilot group of 12 investors, and we've done a lot of engagement work promoting and supporting TCFD. And it's a great tool, and the more companies report to the TCFD, the better able is the market to internalize the information that comes out of that. Nonetheless, TCFD has one major limitation, which is that it's A, not a legal instrument, and B, when it comes to universalizing the data, it goes part of the way there, but not all the way there. So there is a very big place for TCFD, also for SASB, also for the IFRS, everything that can get us closer to an universalized accounting standard. But what I've seen have the greatest effect on company behavior actually has been the non-financial reporting directive, because it just has a reach that we, even as very ambitious asset owners and investors, wouldn't be able to replicate. So I'm hoping that by working together on the regulatory and on the investor initiative and on the accounting standard side, we will come to a point where ESG-relevant material information is disclosed consistently in a granular manner and in a comparable way. And never was the somewhat trite saying information is power truer than when it comes to managing emissions, because once we have these instruments in place, we will be actually able to make the right decisions that create the effects we are after. And we'll be able to prove that they do indeed create these effects, as opposed to relying on, as we currently do, on our very best, very most educated estimate. But it's still an estimate. So, I do hope that we are able at some point to see where we're going with more clarity.
Yeah, Sarah, quite a lot to unpick there. I sensed a couple of moments you wanted to jump in. Any thoughts? No. Sarah, any quick thoughts on that? I can also is that your kitty? I can hear her purring away.
Your headphones are incredibly sensitive there, JB. This is Freya.
I hear all.
Freya has just joined me, which is highly suitable. So actually... And she's a Norwegian forest cat, actually. Oh. So I think that's very appropriate. TCFD does clearly identify where coalitions of like-minded financial service providers really can make a difference by coming together. And I think what they're able to do also is rise above the politics. And what you can sometimes see in initiatives that come out of governments is politicians are usually concerned with getting elected in 4 years' time, whereas fund managers are very interested in making sure that they keep their mandate for the longest possible time, 25, 30 years. And sometimes, well, not even sometimes, usually, invariably, have a lot more insight into these issues. So while the European process, I think, was very helpful, I was a bit disappointed in that because so much good evidence was ignored in terms of what the metrics should be. And I am actually extremely worried that those metrics are seen as it forever. Laws are very hard to change, whereas principles which are created by the industry, for the industry, based on evidence, can move much more quickly. And so, for example, I thought that there were a lot more governance indicators and social indicators I would have liked to have seen in the taxonomy. So I'm a great believer in standards. It's something that we've been fighting for a very, very long time. It's about having standardized ingredients, but each investor needs to basically make their own cake, as it were, with those standardized ingredients, because there is a very, very real risk that we will all be chasing the same indicators, looking at the problems in the same way. And we just do not know enough about what climate change will inevitably bring because it's such a volatile and complex environment. So I think we should be encouraging diversity within a standards framework. And this is, I think, where the power of the shareholders, the power of the asset managers, to then react quickly to the changes that we see from one year to the next. You know, when I started in governance, you know, there was a big focus on audit committees. That then disappeared. Nobody was looking at audit committees. Then it was remuneration. And so I, just as a professional researcher, I do feel it's important to keep an open mind, definitely drive for standards. But the cooperation between investors through GFANS, through IIGCC, this is critical to the next step. And I think the biggest challenge we've got now is in engaging with companies, because Michaela said something very important. Just because you don't invest in Exxon or you don't invest in Shell, you may have decarbonized your portfolio, but you've not decarbonized the planet. And that's actually the biggest issue now is, while emotionally divestment feels very strong and very powerful, it doesn't actually fulfill what we need to do, which is actually decarbonize the entire planet. So there's a lot of room for new technologies to come out. And so I think this is where the diversity of thinking is now crucial to the next step, the next 2 to 3 years. What power is finance going to be able to unleash in terms of new invention? It's all about risk, and you know, the data is critical to being able to manage that risk.
Leads nicely. And I was going to ask, what did COP do for stewardship? You know, beyond voting, how can we better drive those good behaviours towards a just transition? You know, stewardship particularly. But of course, it coincides with the SEC U-turn on shareholder powers as well. So how did those things therefore coalesce from your point of view, Sarah, in terms of driving the aims of COP, but through stewardship, and what is the best way to do that?
You're right about the just transition, and I think that's one of the most under-explained parts of Paris, of the Paris Agreement. You talk to a lot of trustees and you talk about the just transition and it kind of washes over them. It's not something that's been brought out sufficiently. So, yes, I was extremely pleased that the SEC has basically rode back the Trump era regulation changes, not just on proxy, but also on ESG disclosures. So Gary Gensler's team is listening very closely to what investors are saying. And I think that the era of the anti-accountability movement that we saw in the US, I'm not saying it's entirely over, but I think it's close to over, where you now have the SEC sort of mandating disclosures, where you see XBRL taxonomies for disclosure of data around the world becoming more standardized. You've got the accounting profession, the insurance industry, all coalescing around activities which are climate oriented. The big worry that I have is that non-executive directors don't yet have the capability and the capacity to actually understand what some of this means. There is a massive skill shortage everywhere, not just in finance, but in boardrooms, in accounting firms. So education for climate change, I think, is one of the things that I just didn't see much discussion about coming out of Glasgow. But, you know, every MBA school needs to be putting climate change into the heart of its curriculum. Every graduate trainee that comes into finance should be spending their first 2 years in the ESG team, looking at climate change issues before they move into portfolio management, for example. We've just got to put this front and centre in absolutely everything that we do. And it does begin with education, because a lot of the lobbying was based on ignorance. It was based on ignorance of what investors, how they think about risk. And it isn't just about, you know, what modern portfolio theory might have taught everybody sort of 25 years ago. Things have moved on. So whether it's bankers, whether it's company financial advisors, investor relations, corporate lawyers, the insurance firms, that message needs to filter through the bedrock as quickly as possible down to boards, so that boards understand, you know, when they get a say on climate request, this is not just activism for the sake of activism. This is risk management. And this really matters to them. And they need to stop and listen, just not automatically put up the barriers.
And if there's that lack of, as you say, capability or even just that technical knowledge, you know, you need good investment and economic grounding. You need to understand the climate metrics to the point where at least you can therefore try to think how that's going to work through the market, right? So that's, I think it's a fair criticism. I think it's something I've also observed. Is that perhaps the one thing that justifies some of the criticisms that we've seen for initiatives like GFANS? Because we know there is that lack of understanding behind those pledges.
I think it's very careful. We do need to be very careful about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It is very easy to criticise, but I think at the same time we need to focus on the potential. Because I think if we talk down these initiatives too much, people just give up. And we do not need people giving up hope. The problems of climate change are phenomenal. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. This is, you know, we hear existential risk talked about a lot. We can't be falling into a pit of despair that things are not perfect. We cannot let perfection be the enemy of good enough. Everything is perfectible, and I think it's down to professionalism of the individuals involved in these initiatives to now step up and make it happen. We've been given permission to step up and do this, and we just now need to not let people down. And I think that's the biggest issue now. Trust in financial services is still recovering. You know, 2008 left some battle scars for everybody. And we should look to that and say, we don't want to go through that again. We need to up our game. And there's going to be a new generation of people coming into financial services for whom this is business as usual. And they're not going to stand for sort of backsliding. So I think senior leaders of boards, financial services companies, chairs of trustees, some of them might just have to put some of their squeamishness on one side and just say, well, this is now our legal reality. It's our economic reality and it's our social reality. We just need to get on and do it, even if we don't like it, even if we don't understand it. We've got to find a way for this to succeed. So I am a glass half full person rather than a glass half empty. And I think for fund managers, that they've got an enormous task ahead of them. Turning around these giant ships is not an easy task at all. So, you know, this is why it's actually very exciting, even if it's a little disappointing. I don't think the allegations of blah, blah, blah are appropriate for financial services at this time. There's so much more. I mean, I see it every day with the people that I talk to, the ESG teams that I talk to, who are trying incredibly hard to make this a reality. And I think it's just too dismissive just to call it all blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree on the mission. I mean, I've probably spent far too much of my career being in the shadows, Sarah, so I think I'm often accused of being just far too sceptical of everything. But as Bev Shah will remind me, cognitive diversity is a good thing on the boardroom, so that's fine. So I've got a place, but I agree we can't necessarily just shoot down the initiatives because it's easy. And I think perhaps the way Mark Carney's comments on GFANS post the event were taken out of context, I think, to quite an extent. Michaela, so I guess from your point of view, when you look at these big initiatives coming through, the importance of good stewardship, how important is it going to be to essentially demonstrate and evidence the progress being made in those pledges? How do we move forward?
And I actually am happy that Greta T was so outspoken in dismissing a lot of these efforts, because the temptation to point towards, look, we're doing something, we have all of these plans, we don't have that much time. So her job is not to be impressed with us. Her job is to prod us to do better, to do more, to do it quicker. And I think activists are not getting enough credit for how much they've changed the debate and how much sense of urgency they've injected into it. And for that, I think we really need to be grateful to those guys. And I also see it very much when I'm recruiting for my team, the next generation of people who want to go into ESG analysis are also driven by a huge sense of urgency and want to see better mechanisms to produce tangible results. And it's a challenge. It absolutely is a challenge. The short answer to your very, very good question is I don't know, but I'm doing what I can to try and figure it out. But for example, we've spent 2 years promoting the TCFD, and what we can point to is maybe a handful of companies that have committed to disclosing in line with the TCFD. And those are successes that are very important, but is it enough? Is it quick enough? I have a lot of time for the work, for example, of Climate Action 100 Plus, because the way they analyze company portfolios actually makes it very useful for us when making decisions whether to allocate capital to these companies or not. So that's great. But in general, I think that you've pointed towards the greatest challenge that investor initiatives have. How can we make sure that the results happen quick enough? How can we make sure that we've done what we've set out to do? And how can we make sure we stay on the ball? I will again point to Climate Action 100 Plus as maybe an example of a really successful one that does these things very, very well. And part of what they do is transparency. Part of what they do is being active at AGMs and empowering shareholders also to make an impact there. And these tools can all be very effective. What we lack again in a challenge is, I guess, scope. And there we need all parts of the puzzles. We need, as Sarah quite rightly mentioned, insurers. We need to be consistent when saying which risks are insurable and which ones are not. We do need investor initiatives, asset owners, asset managers. But again, I realize I'm really probably getting a bit boring with that, but in the end, when it comes to making things tangible, I am very unwilling to let governments and regulators off the hook. Their specific toolbox is also something that we could very, very well use, and that's especially for creating standards and consistency. I can very much identify with what Sarah said because I started in ESG about 11 years ago, 10 and change. And I'm very sad that nobody talks about audit committees anymore because the issue hasn't gone away. It's a fantastically important aspect of corporate governance, and for a while there was great focus in it. And that's an issue I still raise, except I now get far less traction. I think that's a great loss. With corporate remuneration, in many ways, that was a huge failure of investor activism because there were a couple of high-profile against votes. But if you look at what has happened to ratios or what has happened to quantum, it has continued to climb. And I'm not even sure that across the board we have gotten any better at linking them to performance. These things, to a certain extent, are a pity, but they're not threatening the survival of the human species. Climate change does. So we can't let it go the way of the audit committee. And we need, as a society, to make sure together that we deliver on what we need to deliver on in order to, well, in order to ensure our collective continued existence, I would say. So to sum up a very long answer, that is right now what the biggest challenge facing investor initiatives, accountability and making their progress visible and delivering on consistent results. And there, as somebody who's participated in a few of those things, I'd say we need all the systematic support we can get.
I think actually this accountability mechanism is absolutely crucial. And Michaela is absolutely right to raise this. And just to sort of identify what's happening here in the UK with pension schemes is that we're now starting to see, that's both in the public sector and in the private sector, is the trustee boards now having to really engage with and listen to their members. Because they're obviously the ones, you know, they want to retire in a planet that's worth living on, as well as actually having enough money to do so. And for the first time, you now see trustee boards who are actually having to consider the views of their members. And that's a unique change. I've, you know, been in financial services since 1980. And the first time that I've ever seen something like that. Now, it's not yet been reproduced in other markets, but I hope it will do. Because like TCFD, once sort of the ball gets rolling, it takes on a life of its own.
Can I just ask, why did that come around the UK? Because initially it looked like in the DWP's 2018 guidance, they had removed the consultation to have to engage with members, but now we seem to be U-turning. How did we get back on the right path again?
This is where politicians, I think, were listening. And they read the mood music. And I think that this is what sort of the whole geopolitical element of climate change is, that trust in experts, trust in markets, trust in governments had disappeared. And basically the world was not just wobbling because of climate change. It was wobbling because of a lack of trust in the sort of the capitalist project, which had really just seemed to let people down. So, you know, we're trying to level up the planet in terms of ecology, leveling up the planet in terms of making sure everybody has good life chances. And that's not just about jobs, but actually, you know, safe environments to live and work in. And, you know, so that is where the politicians, I think, really have listened. And you've seen DWP, the Minister for Pensions, Guy Opperman, has been absolutely passionate about this from the moment he actually took office. He sees how important it is for people to engage with their pension scheme. And that's, I think, a really big hurdle, is how we get people to understand that they actually are ultimately are the beneficiaries. They are the shareholders in the planet. They are the shareholders in the companies, which are actually going to generate their returns. And that, to me, is one of the most exciting things. It's not very often talked about, and I think that we do need to bring that out. So we're now seeing more investors thinking about how they can engage with their policyholders. We've seen initiatives on pooled fund voting starting to come out. And so once upon a time, we used to have people say, oh, no, we're not going to disclose our voting to the public. Nobody ever looks at those pages. But now you're seeing there's much more demand to understand, well, how do you invest my money? What does investment actually mean? Because sometimes when people realise what investment means and what the power is, I mean, we've seen the videos, people are shocked. They think shareholders are other people. They don't realise it's their own pension scheme that is shareholders. So that's a very exciting, but it's still underdeveloped, because that brings together the sort of the civil society action input into the financial services, and it really democratizes that pension and investment process.
I mean, it makes you just wonder if Facebook could actually be turned to a force for good. But unfortunately, it has just become an instrument for abuse and surveillance capitalism, obviously, by corporates. I just wonder if we could turn that around. Going back to Michaela's point, the thing about regulators and politicians, my worry is that sort of political hokey-cokey that you get. Hokey-cokey, I'm not sure if that's a term that translates particularly well to the Nordics, Michaela, but that's an in-out policy. And thinking about the US leadership here, you know, I'm sure you can recall, I can recall when US failed to commit to Kyoto and pulled itself out, then was maybe back in and pulled itself out again. And of course, we've just come through this very volatile political period with a certain Republican, or supposedly Republican president, and now we've got a Democrat administration. But we're going to have to hold our breath in 2024 again, right? I mean, this could all U-turn. Is there the leadership in amongst the G7, the G8, I don't know where we cut it now, G10, the US, can we actually trust them to stay committed long enough? What of China and India? You know, are they bringing enough leadership to the table? And did the West almost blow COP completely by not showing the due commitments to emerging markets? I mean, where does this leadership come from, and can we rely on the politicians over an extended period? Because this isn't a four-year problem, right? This is a multi-generational, multi-decade
problem. Log in to www.nordea.co.uk and find out the latest ESG insights from the Responsible Investing Team. Billy Jensen, Head of Fundamental Equities at Nordea Asset Management, writes, Waste and Opportunity, How to Capitalize on Plastics. Hilda writes, Every year, an estimated 8 million tons of plastics end up in our ocean. Log in to also access the ESG Matters accredited ESG Learning Centre, where Nordea share knowledge, expertise and values for advisors and investment professionals only.
Actually, China is the one best positioned to tackle it, or Russia, because there you've had the same people running the show for 30 years, for better or worse. And I have heard very much question whether democracy can deliver the right tools for long-term decision-making. If you like, that's not a new issue. In many ways, you have the same questions here when it comes to pension insurance, right? And I would say that I'm still to see a better way to do it than a democratic system. Because if you know that you're going to be running a country, or your ambition is to be running a country for 20 years, then it can be frightfully hard to change your mind. Mm-hmm. Yes. Governments in a westernized democracy change quickly, but as in your own example, the very climate skeptical Republican president that used to have the say, at least he only had 4 years of that policy, and voters were able to change things around. Of course, then you have the risk that it might all go back the other way again. The thing is that, yes, democracy does have this feature, but it can be a strength as much as it is a weakness. Because I do not hope for climate change leadership to come out of Russia, say, because the incentives for the current government there to change its mind on climate change are not big. They sadly are not. China is a very interesting actor in that regard, and I wish I had more expertise in order to be able to make a sufficiently intelligent point there. But it's an extremely interesting beast with a very decisive role to play in that. So to go back on your question on where do we see leadership and where should the leadership come in from? I think in the end, we can't really avoid Western democracies there. And the contest is tougher than it should be, because we've seen the system be made so corruptible. We've seen such vulnerabilities exposed. It's to a certain extent shocking, really. But that's in the end, if it works properly, only a proxy for what the public wants, and the public overwhelmingly wants, as all the surveys show, action on climate change taken. So the support for that is very, very high indeed. So you have to, however, as the big actors in a democratic society, have a huge awareness of your responsibility to keep it safe and stable. And I'm glad you mentioned Facebook, because if you have a huge platform, then it's your responsibility that platform transmits information in a balanced and accurate way. And more needs to be done to ensure that this is the case. And I will add another thing when it comes to business, because for better or worse, Sarah is absolutely right. Businesses right now in Western democracies have an unprecedented amount of power. And when it comes to that, what I'd like to see is a much higher degree of alignment between the policies that businesses make individually and the policies that their trade associations pursue at all levels. So what I'd like to see there is a much higher standard of civil society behavior across the board. Because if we know at all members of the, at all links of the chain, that we need to be consistent in our positions, that if you are, say, a big steel producer, you can't say one thing in your annual report and commit to one kind of a pledge and then have your trade association or Business Europe lobby to soften climate targets. We need to raise standards. I wish, as somebody who's normally very much pro-regulation, I wish there was a regulatory response to that. And I wish I could say something in terms of practical suggestions, but there isn't. It's really up to the individual's consciousness and to the consciousness of groups of individuals. And the fact that we do have that degree of freedom is both the risk and the source of strength of a democratic system. We can mess up things very badly, very quickly, but we can also turn around. So that's ultimately, I hope that we as societies will have enough educated and switched on and motivated individual members and organizations willing to provide that leadership, and that we also have governments that are willing to and able to and competent enough to translate that will into sensible instruments. So it can't come from one place only. It might be handier, but it also comes with a whole host of other risks, which I don't think that the species and the planet can afford to carry at the moment.
Sarah, I'd be fascinated as well on your thoughts on the big social media. I mean, the likes of Facebook. You and I were chatting not so long ago about, you know, reimagining Adam Smith's values into the 21st century. I'd kind of like to maybe sit Zuckerberg down with moral sentiments, perhaps, and just maybe make him a little bit more aware of his importance in politics, because we can't actually disconnect social media and politics anymore. And, you know, when I look at the revelations of Influence Map that 25 oil companies paid for ads on Facebook that were viewed 431 million times just in 2020. I mean, this is it's a complex problem. How do you see that?
You're right. It is almost an intractable problem, because obviously, you know, technology for disseminating ideas has always been seen as challenging, from, you know, the development of movable type and or even sort of wax tablets beforehand. You know, they are very powerful communications technologies. And I think that what's the biggest challenge I see is leaders of firms trying to insulate themselves from shareholders by disenfranchising them, because this you've seen this even in the UK with people suggesting that, oh, well, we should abandon one share, one vote. The reality is that boards of directors are not accountable to governments. They have to comply with the law, obviously, pay their taxes, and some of them should pay more. Mm. But at the end of the day, shareholders have the ability to remove directors, put in new directors. And when it comes to ESG, that's been a very, very underutilized power. And it doesn't need government permission to vote off a board, which, you know, where its lobbying is opaque, or actually even where it's blindingly obvious that it's contradictory, for example. But what we've seen is a sort of a hollowing out of that democratic process over the years, because many parts of the financial services industry didn't take it seriously, didn't actually understand how important it actually was for getting the kinds of changes that you want. And so, you know, you can see where people have exercised their franchise, change happens. And it can happen incredibly quickly. You know, come next March, April and May, you could see more asset owners just stepping up, using their proxies to actually say, this is not acceptable. We are not going to stand for such low grade disclosures. stop blaming intermediaries. This is your responsibility. We have put you in position to look after our interests. You're not looking after our interests. You're not treating shareholders fairly if you are prioritizing executive compensation over having a good climate transition plan, for example. So in this regard, I think particularly so many American firms have been insulated from shareholders for so long. And I don't think it's necessarily just a Facebook problem. Yes, there is a problem with all kinds of media where you have got sort of a coercive control, what seems to be a coercive control to just purely, quotes, maximizing shareholder return. But over what period? And there is no point maximizing shareholder return over the next quarter if your reputation is shot to pieces. So I think that this is where the education of the boards question comes up. This is not about proxy advisors or ESG rating agencies getting activist. We are reflecting back through the information that we're getting that there is something fundamentally rotten in many of these organizations. So whistleblowing. Are people feeling confident about speaking up and protecting the reputation of the company? Trying to fix Facebook is not something I think that shareholders can do just by themselves, however. And this is something which is it's a multi-stakeholder problem. And we're not going to solve it overnight.
That's a brilliant point, actually, about not being insulated from shareholders. Because if you look at a lot of companies with problematic behaviors, you will see some sort of limitation on shareholder power somewhere in there. Either a disconnect between economic state or, and voting state for the founder, or a dual class share structure, or an overpowerful anchor shareholder or something. And being less accepting of that sort of setup when listing a company, I think that's something that stock exchanges could help with a lot.
Well, actually, increasingly, stock exchanges don't have control over the listing rules. That's now been separated out because I think there was a terrible conflict of interest. So you often see that the listing authority is independent of the stock exchange. I think stock exchanges these days as technology platforms shouldn't be trying to change company law. And that's what they have done in the past. They have basically interfered with these fundamental ownership rights. And it's something I get very exercised about. The courts don't usually want to get involved in shareholder disputes until shareholders have used all of the tools that they have at their disposal. But what we have seen is this, and the US is a very good case in point, where through some of the very big trade associations, just attacking shareholders indirectly and directly and diminishing their point of view and frankly disrespecting the providers of capital. You know, pension schemes, ordinary shareholders are the people that are providing the risk capital. And what shareholders don't want is for companies to use that capital to blow up the planet. And yeah, we do need some better discourse. And so I think the challenge now is between investors and their investee companies, not just the chief executive, but the chair of the board, the chair of the risk committee, the chair of the remuneration committee, to help them understand this is not a flash in the pan. This is international law we're talking about here. You don't understand what the just transition is. Fine, go and educate yourself. That's what we're all doing in financial services. There's a lot of change ahead. And you are either with the program or, sorry, if you don't want that board seat, if you can't contribute in a constructive way, it's time for you to leave the job to somebody who can do it.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Absolutely. And in the end, I think you raise another very interesting point there, company law. And when it comes to, for example, the voting structure of Facebook, I do feel it's a very interesting question of can this sort of setup be prevented and whose job is it to prevent it? I agree with you that the best place to solve this issue is indeed company law, and in some ways stipulating that boards need to be competent in climate risks might also find a good home there. It won't be equally possible in all jurisdictions, but it certainly strikes me as the right or one of the right instruments.
Yeah, and for as much as Climate Action 100 has been focusing on those very, very important ones, there are, you know, 12,000 quoted companies around the world. They are, you know, consumers of carbon intensive products. And this is about the decarbonisation of the entire planet. It isn't just about those 100 companies. Yes, they are important, but I worry, and this is a little bit like market cap weighted indices problem, is there is the rest of the economy, and that actually we bring the whole economy to bear on the problem by spreading the word as widely as possible. So that's why I was so particularly pleased about COP actually having a finance day. It's the first time that this has happened. It's a formal recognition that the economy needs investors to decarbonize and to have impact. And so, you know, what's the old saying? You know, mighty oaks from little acorns do grow. And we need a lot more acorns and we need a lot more mighty oaks. But it's a start, and that's why I remain optimistic.
And that feels like a great place to end our episode. I just want to finish by just saying I deeply enjoyed that. My absolute gratitude, Sarah and Michaela. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, JB. It's always a pleasure. Nice to meet you, Michaela. And it doesn't matter what the marginal differences that we have, that they actually, I believe, contribute to the diversity of the dialogue. But, you know, it's time to get excited about climate. As much as we are pessimistic, we're not going to solve the problems through out-and-out pessimism. We've just got to get people motivated to do this.
Thank you, JB, and thank you, Sarah, for the excellent questions and the very, very high-quality debate. I really enjoyed myself.
COP26, UN Climate Conference, COP26.
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 It's the 26th Conference of Parties.
In Glasgow, we are looking for action.
Log in to www.nordea.co.uk and find out the latest ESG insights from the Responsible Investing team. Hilde Jensen, Head of Fundamental Equities at Nordea Asset Management, writes Waste and Opportunity, How to Capitalize on Plastics. Hilde writes that every year an estimated 8 million tonnes of plastics end up in our ocean. Log in to also access the ESG Matters accredited ESG Learning Centre, where Nordea share knowledge, expertise and values for advisors and investment professionals only.
COP26 UN Climate Conference, COP26.
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 It's the 26th Conference of Parties.
COP26.
Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
We are not on track to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. Not even close.
The eyes of the world will be on the United Kingdom, and Scotland in particular, as leaders come together.
There could not be a more important moment that we should have international agreements. It is crucial that these meetings in Glasgow, COP26, have success.
Climate change is the greatest risk facing us all, and COP26 will bring parties from across the globe together to accelerate action towards the goals of the Paris Agreement and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. GEFI is a non-profit based in Scotland with a global footprint. We're dedicated to enabling finance to deliver positive change and help achieve the SDGs.